Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
You know, we all have so many data points in our past. And, you know, I look at everything through the lens of productivity. But, you know, this is what I so often find in writing about productivity is, you know, people want to focus more and people want to have more energy and people want to be more motivated by their work. But and so they try to look forward into the future to find ways to become more productive and more focused and more passionate about what they do instead of looking behind and noticing, wait, every time I've been fired up about my work, I was, you know, doing a podcast interview. Maybe I should start a podcast. Every time I've been productive, I've been taming distractions or I've been on a deadline. Maybe I should find more deadlines or seek out ways to make my work a bit more threatening. You know, every time I've had a ton of energy to bring to my work, I've been taking a lot of breaks at work. I've been having a consistent exercise regimen or a meditation regimen. Maybe I should pick that back up. So yeah, like you said, we have all these data points, but we just need to look back for them. It seems weird to kind of look into the past, but that's how we've lived our lives up to this point. And if we want to find a direction and a trajectory that's different from where we are, that's more productive, that's more focused, that's more meaningful, I think that's a great place to start.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Chris, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, man. It's good to be back. This is like time number three.
Yeah, you're one of the rare few guests that we've had back more than twice for good reason. I've been a big fan of your work, loved your latest book, Hyperfocus, which we're going to talk about in detail. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living and what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Both my parents are psychologists. And I think this is why I try to dissect my own mind so much, as well as the minds of other people and how we work and how we think and the biases we have. And they're also quite risk averse, which, you know, doing what I do for a living, it's quite risky to be out on your own. Hopefully doing things for an audience of one, which turns into an audience of many. And so, you know, that kind of blends into what I do. So I do what I do despite the fact that I'm risk averse, but I think because of the fact that my parents are weirdos and are into psychology.
Yeah. So anytime I talk to somebody who has been exposed to a wide array of sort of personal development or information about how to manage their psychology, I'm always of the impression that, oh, you must have been raised with this like perfect subconscious programming and turned out totally normal, which I'm guessing you're going to dispel that myth for me. But what are the misperceptions that we might have about the fact that you had parents who were psychologists that would make us think that you've been raised perfectly? Yeah.
I think that they wanted to continue working when they came home. Just like anybody else, just like if somebody's a massage therapist, for an example, who comes home exhausted, they might not give their family therapeutic massages every night. I think a similar thing is true. And my fiance, whenever she's met my parents, which has been quite often, she's always afraid that they're going to dissect her and read her like a book. And the truth is that they probably could, but at the same time, they don't really care to because it's just more work. And so I think that's a misconception that, you know, everybody kind of needs a break and your family is so often your break. You know, it's where you recharge. It's where you get more energy from. And so I think there's probably a few things that's played in the background about this, but, you know, I think it's part of my story, but not a big part of my story, I think.
What lessons did they pass on about managing your own psychology? What are the narratives that you were raised with around mental health? The reason that I ask this is because I know in the Indian culture, the sort of default narrative around anything mental health is, oh, well, therapy is for crazy people. We don't do that.
Yeah.
I believed that for a very long time until I found myself in a therapist office at 37. And my only question was, what the hell took me so long to get here?
Yeah. It's the narratives around mental health, I think they were just, you know, I love these questions because they're making me think immediately off the bat, as opposed to just reverting to the same, you know, kind of points about the book. But I think the narrative around mental health was an interesting one, because the families that we have, that both my parents' sides, they were the ones who came to my parents for help. And so very much, maybe the family outside of my parents wasn't so open about mental health, but they were quite open about mental health. I've seen psychologists, not very many good ones, who have actually helped me dissect my mind more than, say, a meditation practice could. But it's I think that inclination towards exploration has been in the background. And I think the openness is there, but I just haven't really labeled it as such. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. It makes sense. Did they pass on any particular lessons about managing self-esteem, dealing with things like depression or failure or setback that you think have had an impact on who you've become?
I don't think so. And that's, it might sound like an odd answer, but it's just something we didn't talk about. Yeah.
Wow.
I think they were very much about promoting how we explored our own minds, but didn't necessarily prod us. And I think this was a hesitation that they had in a way, where they didn't want to get us to be some way. They didn't, you know, get us to go to a particular church. They didn't get us to try to do a particular profession. They really just say, okay, you know, find out who you are. And so the work was on me. And so there was, you know, kind of little guidance, but I think that kind of scrappy mental nature, it kind of made for that, the curious nature that is hopefully behind most of the things that I do today. And so, yeah, it was kind of that curiosity that's embedded within me, maybe the tendency toward connecting different disparate pieces of information might be in me too. But yeah, this is a fun.
We'll get to that. I know you talked about that in the book. The other part of this that I wonder, mainly because I'm working on an outline for a new book about the impact that our social programming has on us. You mentioned that they were risk averse, and despite the fact that they were risk averse, you have developed a capacity for risk. I guess the question is then, how does somebody who has been raised with social programming that has taught them to be risk averse develop a capacity for risk despite that programming?
I think that you find what you're so curious and passionate about that you will do that thing despite all the risk. And so I think when you know that you're so into something that you absolutely have to do it despite the risk that exists, that's a sign that you've found something that you're truly passionate about. And, you know, some people have weird curiosities. I would include myself in that mix with productivity. I think I've talked about this on the show before, but there was a point when I graduated university and I received a few job offers where I had the choice of going the traditional route, but I thought, okay, I'm so much of a nerd about productivity. Let's experiment with this. Let's explore this for a year. So I declined the jobs to start what became the productivity project. And I think, you know, doing that despite the risk. So if you're risk averse, I just think you need to find that thing that you can't stop thinking about, that you can't stop just perseverating on as you do other things. You know, look at how you spend your free time, what you consume, what you connect, who you talk to people about. That's, I think, a sign that you're truly into something, that, you know, doing, like you say, doing the work for the work's sake, because you can't get it off of your mind and you can't think about doing anything else.
Yeah. So you chose not to accept a job right after college. So I wonder, what would you say to people who might be listening who are either in college right now or about to finish college about what you've just said? Is this something that you think everybody should do, or is it something that people should consider experimenting with? I just wondered what your advice would be for
them. It's definitely not something most people should do. what I would recommend, and I remember I was a recruiter at a big technology company for a while through university. And one of the things that we looked for when we were hiring people, in fact, the main thing that we looked for was how people spent their spare spare time. And so, you know, these were co-op students who were in university. And the ones that we hired, more often than not, they were in the co-op program, so they actually had some real experience. But B, they had signals that they were curious about what they were studying beyond just university. And so I would look to that point as a starting point. How do you spend your free time? It's the classic question. If Srini, you know, he decided to give you all the royalties from all his books, and I decided to as well, you win this grand contest, and you don't have to worry about money anymore. You have a constant amount rolling in. How do you spend your time when you have that total flexibility? You know, some random guy leaves you in his will for $100 million. How do you spend every day of your life? And chances are you would spend it how you spend a lot of your free time already. You know, whether it's reading books about productivity, whether it's painting, whether it's illustrating, whatever your art happens to be, I would look at that place as a place to start. And so I would find ways, and this is, I'm going way back to when I graduated. This is kind of fun. You know, find ways and places where what you're studying intersects with what you're passionate about. If they overlap and the Venn diagram is just a circle, then I think you continue to find a career in that. But you know, the thing that I've realized in talking to people in exploring these ideas is wherever you work, assuming it's a job, you'll get a paycheck. And so if it's for yourself, you know, you'll probably struggle to get by, but chances are you'll find a way because you give yourself no choice but to find a way. So I would look at where your skills and your passions overlap and use that as it might be common sense advice, but at the time that I was graduating, I thought, okay, I have this degree and I have these job offers, but there's little overlap between these offers and what I'm actually curious and passionate about. So I found the overlap. It was productivity because I have a business degree. I couldn't find a job in which I could experiment and explore that. So I said, F it, you know, let's decline these jobs and experiment with productivity for a year, which then turned into a career which is now a calling. And now I get to write books and do talks around the world about this idea. So it can work out this way. And if you give yourself no choice but to make it work out that way, I think your odds are even better.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up the passion idea. And I think the thing that's interesting was that you preceded it by saying that there are a lot of experiments and exploration, which I think often people have this idea that they have some predetermined passion, which is ridiculous because you have no data points to make that kind of a decision about what you're passionate about. And I think that you know, when you really do find something engaging, that's when a passion starts to emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. And I think, you know, we all have so many data points in our past. And, you know, I look at everything through the lens of productivity. But, you know, this is what I so often find in writing about productivity is, you know, people want to focus more and people want to have more energy and people want to be more motivated by their work. And so they try to look forward into the future to find ways to become more productive and more focused and more passionate about what they do, instead of looking behind and noticing, wait, every time I've been fired up about my work, I was, doing a podcast interview. Maybe I should start a podcast. Every time I've been productive, I've been taming distractions or I've been on a deadline. Maybe I should find more deadlines or seek out ways to make my work a bit more threatening. You know, every time I've had a ton of energy to bring to my work, I've been taking a lot of breaks at work. I've been having a consistent exercise regimen or a meditation regimen. Maybe I should pick that back up. So yeah, like you said, we have all these data points, but we just need to look back for them. It seems weird to kind of look into the past, but that's how we've lived our lives up to this point. And if we want to find a direction and a trajectory that's different from where we are, that's more productive, that's more focused, that's more meaningful, I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Well, we've talked to you before about how you ended up sort of landing where you're at, and you kind of alluded to some of it in this conversation as well. Was there anything early on in your life that planted your seed for this interest of all things in productivity? Because for somebody as young as you were to decide, you know what, this is what I'm passionate about, a very strange passion.
Yeah, it really is. I think it was feeling that the absence of things to do in my mind. And I first got this feeling of absence. It's kind of a weird way to phrase it, but it really makes sense to me. I hope it makes sense to you too. The first place I got it was reading Getting Things Done by David Allen, which the whole system is about getting the things you have to do into an external list or some sort of system so that you have more attention with which to focus throughout the day. And so that was kind of the first feeling that I had, you know, outside of a vacation where I was actively doing a lot of work and had a lot of projects on my plate. Mind you, these aren't very important projects. These were like book reports in high school way back when. But I felt that feeling of, okay, I have so much to do, but I know that when I work on something, that everything's somewhere, that I can just totally focus and become immersed in what I'm doing. And so maybe there's something to this whole productivity thing. And so I think so much of productivity, you know, we talk about doing more and accomplishing more, but I think there's that deeper feeling when it comes to product. That feeling, like we only get a bit of that feeling sometimes, and it's often when we do something and it's not on our to-do list and we cross that off and it feels amazing. But I think we can feel that way all the time, whatever we're doing, that's where we need to be. And I think that's kind of the power of working with intention behind what we do, where there's that in the moment confidence that where we are is where we need to be. And I've gotten this feeling where, you know, I had that total confidence once more. And it was on the publicity tour for the last book of all places, you know, kind of a situation that I didn't expect to find myself in, but somehow managed to get there, where, you know, we were doing 10 interviews in a day, back to back to back to back. But there was somebody all the time to get me water or get me food. And, you know, just as I felt hunger beginning to encroach on my mental space, there was a meal in front of me. And I knew there was somebody telling, okay, you have to go here now, and we're going to drive you here now. And wherever I was, I knew that that was exactly where I needed to be. And I think there's that confidence embedded within intention where we feel that sense of purpose in the moment. And so I think, you know, that feeling is worth chasing.
Yeah. So what prompted this idea of hyperfocus? I mean, obviously, we know that our issues with distraction and attention are at an all-time high. We've had Cal Newport here to talk about deep work. So what is it that planted your what planted the seed for your interest in this subject in particular?
Honestly, and this is, it's tough to admit sometimes, but it's noticing how distracted that I was after publishing the first book. And you know, you have to know, and that a lot of the advice that I gave in the first book centered around focusing deeper and resisting distractions and managing our attention. But yet, once that book was shipped, I found myself in a state of distraction where, you know, I couldn't focus. I was surrounded by novel notifications, and it was because I wasn't on a deadline of some sort. And that led me to think, okay, if I'm in this situation as somebody who makes his living studying and speaking about and writing about productivity, maybe other people who aren't as into productivity are A, facing this puzzle, but, you know, B, that I wasn't seeing the full picture of just how distracted we are and how we can actually tame these distractions as opposed to falling victim to them. So that was very much the impetus. But it's worth admitting because we're all human.
So let's get into the concepts in this book. Let's start with this idea of attentional space. Can you define it for us and talk about how we can make ours better?
Yeah, for sure. So we only have so much attention to give to the world around us in the moment. And I think most of us are aware that our attention is limited, blah, blah, blah. We've heard this a lot of times before, but we don't really internalize just how limited things are. And this was something that surprised me. I was, you know, going through all the research that I could find on the topic, reading these these studies from front to back. I don't know. I think a lot of people say they read studies, studies from front to back, but they don't actually do it. But essentially, they're very dry. They're very dry, some of these studies. But we can only hold, after we pay attention to something, we can only hold so much in our mind at one time. And a lot of the ideas in the research or surrounding attention, they're kind of like difficult to connect with on some level. And I found this idea of our working memory capacity, how much information we can hold in our mind at one moment, coming up again and again and again and again, where this is the mental scratch pad that we use to hold information in our mind. It's kind of like the equivalent of a computer's RAM, but for our brain. And it's very limited, this working memory capacity. So I use the term attentional space as a way of framing this idea. And what we do when we focus on something is we welcome it into this attentional space. But, you know, like you were saying, it's quite limited. We used to think we could hold around 7 unique chunks of information in our short-term memory at one time. But the latest research shows that we can hold around 3 or 4 chunks of information. And the world is structured around this. You know, it's structured around threes. We have sayings like, good things come in threes, and the third time's the charm, and celebrities die in threes. And we even, you know, we chunk things naturally into threes and fours. A good example of this is phone numbers, which are usually, you know, three numbers, then four numbers. We don't say, you know, my phone number is 1,784,600. We say my phone number is 1-613-89, you know, and so this is how we're meant to think. But the idea is that because we can only fit a few things in our mind at one time, we need to manage our attention more deliberately. We can't carry on two conversations at one time. We can't even do two complex things at one time. At best, we can do a complex thing while doing something habitual, like working out while listening to a podcast or doing our laundry while we listen to a podcast or an audiobook. And so it's essential, and we can multitask with habits. We can use the attentional space to do that. But when it comes to our most complex work, it requires so much of our attention that we need to give our attention to the complex tasks that we have more completely. And so, yeah, it's this idea that by managing this space, which is just what we're focusing on in the moment, we better manage our life and every aspect of it.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
So I think for most people hearing that, the first thought that comes to mind is the things digitally that compete for your attention. And after talking with Adam Ghazali, who's a neuroscientist whose work I'm sure you're familiar with, given the nature of what you do, the thing that became very clear to me is the importance of your physical space when it comes to attention management. So what did your own work show about this?
Yeah, one of the more illuminating things that I saw repeating and reverberating through the research, maybe he was talking about this too, is the way that our attention is wired. Because the key, I think, to understanding distractions is that the reason we fall victim to them is that in the moment, what we see as a distraction is just a more attractive object of attention than what we truly want and ought to be doing. And the way we see it as more attractive, our attention is wired to pay attention to anything that is one of three things by default. The first is anything that is pleasurable. We pay attention to. The second is anything that is threatening. We pay attention to. And the third is anything that is novel. We naturally pay attention to. There's even a novelty bias embedded within our brain's prefrontal cortex, where we naturally get more of a release of dopamine, a pleasure chemical, whenever we focus on something that our brain sees as shiny. And this aided us well in our evolutionary history, because we, instead of hyper focusing on building a fire for our tribe, our village, we noticed the novel threat encroaching in on our environment, the saber-toothed tiger that was sneaking up. We paid attention to the threat, we dealt with the threat, and we evolved to live another day and build another fire. And the same is true with the novel pleasures in our environment, where we evolved to notice berries hanging from a tree or potential mates, which also allowed us to reproduce and aided our chances at survival. But these days, there aren't many tigers roaming the streets. There are some cougars, but not very many tigers. I should have made that joke in the book. And the nearest threats are few and far between. And the same brain mechanisms that allowed us to survive through today are what are hijacked from anything that we see as a distraction. And so, you talk about the environment. We anything in front of us that is more pleasurable or threatening or novel than the work that we truly want to be doing, we're going to have to resist it and expend mental energy in order to realign our attention towards what's more pleasurable and threatening and novel. Looking around me in the office right now, I have a bunch of plants. I have a meditation cushion. There's my turtle, Edward, basking on her rock. You can't tell the gender of a turtle when you get it. But, and there's various things that I could pay attention to, but I've designed the space so that nothing in it is more attractive in the moment than the work that I want to be doing. And of course, most of the distractions are digital. So the phone is in another room. The iPad is in another room. And I don't have a distractions blocker enabled on my computer right now, but it's because a conversation like this consumes most of my attention in the first place. And so, you know, there's kind of two environments, I think, that we need to manage. There's the physical environment and the digital environment. And I would lend even more credence to the digital environments because they're where we spend so much of our time.
Yeah. I mean, I that's why I dedicated an entire chapter to environments and audience of one, because I was just blown away by the impact both physical and digital environments have on all of your behavior, which, you know, we've talked endlessly on the show about how to deal with distractions. So I don't want to spend, you know, too much time on that idea. Let's get into this concept of hyperfocus and what it means, how you define it, and what are the benefits in terms of performance that result from hyperfocus.
Yeah. So I define hyperfocus. It originates in ADHD literature, where it's when somebody with ADHD brings their full attention to something. I use that same term, but to mean this, but to mean that complete focus, but coupled with deliberate attention. So in other words, we choose what we focus on before we focus on something. And I think that's a key to productivity, where the most productive people, they don't work on this autopilot mode in response to the work that comes their way or lands in their email inbox. They're the ones who choose more often throughout the day what they focus on and what they work on before they work on anything. And so I think, you know, the one of the beautiful parts about writing this book is that I found that our attention has these natural rhythms that we follow. You know, we're focused on something, our attention then gets distracted. You know, people have done distractions to death. I think everything surrounding that, but distractions too, is fascinating. You know, so we get distracted by something internal or external to us. They're about 50-50 in terms of what derails us. And then we bring our attention back. So we can model some steps by which we can hyperfocus on our work and become more likely to do what Cal refers to as deep work, what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi refers to as this flow state, where we look up at the clock, we think 20 minutes have gone by and it's 3 hours since we started working on something. So we're more likely to get into this state when we model some steps by which we can focus more deeply on our work after this natural rhythm that we follow to focus better. So we start by focusing on something so we can choose what to focus on in the first place. Then you eliminate as many external and internal distractions as you can. And the key is there, as you can, because like a hiccup, there will be things that come up over the course of working that you can't tame, like office visitors and things like that. And then once you've laid the groundwork, you've chosen something to do that's important, you've eliminated anything that is more pleasurable, threatening, or novel in the moment than what you want to be doing, then you bring your attention to that intention and continually draw it back while you bring your mind back gently. And I think that's the key, is that our mind wanders an awful lot against our will. It wanders around 47% of the day, but we only notice that our mind has wandered 5 times every hour. And so, in other words, we can fall down a rabbit hole of distraction, or we can get into this state of mind wandering without intention. Quite often, and we can fall into it for quite a long time without knowing that we're in it. And so, you know, that's kind of the final step, is bring our attention back when we notice that it's veered off the course.
Yeah. So I think that most people understand the general concept behind this. But the thing is that what I've learned, at least, is that the capacity for attention and to have it sustain over a long period of time is something that you have to practice building. I know for a fact that if you had asked me when I was 29 or 30 to sit down and to write for an hour, hour and a half at the beginning of the day, That would have been a tall order, which is ironic considering how many more distractions that we have in the world today. I mean, as somebody who is ADD, I think for me, many of these things are necessities. They're not things that I do because I'm passionate about productivity like yourself.
Yeah.
For me, they're like, if I didn't do these things, I wouldn't get a damn thing done. But how do people raise that capacity for managing attention? I know you talked a bit about meditation. What are the other ways that it can be done? Mm-hmm.
Well, the way to raise your capacity to focus for longer is to lower how stimulated you are by default. And so we feel this sort of restlessness and boredom and anxiety whenever we transition downward from a state of high stimulation into a state of lower stimulation. That's the definition that I use for boredom, is adjusting down into a state of lower stimulation. Because once we're there, we don't experience boredom anymore, but it's as we're doing the adjusting that we feel restless and uncomfortable. And so I think this is something that is worth chipping away at over time, where and a way to do this, and a helpful strategy that I love, is to shrink how long you'll focus for until you no longer feel that resistance. So, you know, at the start, if you're like me, you might not be able to focus on one thing for 10 minutes if you're not on a deadline. And so, you know, shrink how long you're going to work on something until you feel no resistance to it. So, you know, could I write for an hour today? No, the thought of it puts me off. Okay, what about 45 minutes? 30? 20? 50? Yeah, I can do 15. And then you focus for 15 minutes. You find that resistance level. You tame distractions. And then over time, as you ritualize this idea, you block off periods in your calendar to get into this mode. Over time, you lower that default level of stimulation, the amount of dopamine coursing through your brain because of this novelty bias that's embedded within us, and you become better able to think more deeply about your work. And this is, I think, something that others miss, is that we can't just tame distractions and then work productively every day. We need to, over time, chip away at this level of stimulation to think more deeply and focus on one thing for a longer period of time. And so that's what I would suggest. And this is easier said than done, but it comes from, it's way easier, especially for somebody with ADHD. But over time, you begin to notice the quality of your attention increasing. And then you notice how much you accomplish increasing, but also how meaningful your life is. Because and this is, you know, kind of a big takeaway for me from this project, is that the state of it's more than just productivity. You know, we talk about, oh, we should resist distractions because they derail us so often. But if there's one thing that shines through the research, it's that the state of our attention is what determines the state of our lives. If we're distracted in every moment, those moment-to-moment experiences accumulate to create a life that is filled with distraction. We live a distracted life and we never feel like we have a sense of purpose. But if we choose, more often than not, what we focus on and make that thing productive and make that thing meaningful, whether it's a conversation with you on a podcast, whether it's a dinner with a loved one, whether it's reading a good book, and we bring our attention to that, then our moment-by-moment experiences become more productive and meaningful, and then those accumulate and build up to create a productive and meaningful life. And I think this is, you know, we talk about distraction and stuff in the moment, but this is the power of managing your attention, is the state of your attention builds up to determine the state of your life. And so it's so worth, you know, you could tell I get a bit fired up by this idea, but it's because I've noticed this in myself. I feel more meaning in what I do. I'm more fired up by what I do. And it's because of these ideas.
Wow. Okay. So one, I'm stealing that phrase, the state of your attention determines the state of your life, and writing it as a blog post. I'll make sure I credit you and link to Hyperfocus.
You don't even have to credit me. It's fine. Yeah. I just want this idea to get out there, man.
Yeah. And I agree, because I actually wrote a piece on Medium titled that attention is the currency of achievement. And I ended it by saying, all you have to do is look at this one fact. Mark Zuckerberg has become a billionaire by doing one thing, capturing your attention.
Hmm. Yeah. It's so true. What is more novel or pleasurable or threatening than a Facebook notification, which happens to be the same colors as the berries that we evolved to pay attention to?
Maybe sex.
Maybe sex. Yeah, it's funny, you know, talking about mind wandering.
Yeah.
I wrote a bit in the book about like what leads our mind to wander. And so the more immersed we become in what we're doing in the moment, the happier we are. And the thing that leads our mind to wander the least happens to be sex. I have the list here. Number five is listening to music.
Yeah.
Number four is playing in one way or another, you know, a creative hobby. Three is talking and investing in our relationships. Two is exercising. And one is making love. And you could do all five at one time if you really want.
Amazing. So I think that actually really makes a perfect segue to getting into this concept of scatter focus. So you said basically when, you know, the section on scatter focus, I have this here in front of me. There's this quote that I'm pulling up. Give me just a sec here. Actually, you know what? I don't have it in front of me, but here it is. Just as hyperfocus is the most productive mode of the brain, scatter focus is the most creative. Scatter focus can derail our productivity when our original intent is to focus, but when we're coming up with a creative solution to a problem, planning for our future or making a difficult decision, it's just as essential as hyperfocus. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So distraction tends to fill the spare moment of our lives like water. Water is very much on my mind. It's a beautiful rainy day here in rainy Kingston, Ontario, Canada. It feels so relaxing. I have a tea here. I have some water. And it's very relaxing to talk to you. It's such like a rainy day to spend indoors. But yeah, it's, I don't even know where I was going. See, sometimes we distract ourselves even when we're really good at paying attention to things. But I think, you know, traffic flow is one of my favorite things to study in addition to productivity. And if you look at how traffic flows down the highway, what allows cars to continue moving forward isn't how fast they're moving, paradoxically. It's how much space exists between the cars that allows them to continue moving forward. And I would argue that our attention is much the same way. Now, this, when our mind wanders against our will, it's terrible for our productivity because we're not progressing toward our intentions. But when we set out time to deliberately let our mind wander. And, you know, doing anything habitual gets you into this. Taking a bit longer of a shower in the morning, swimming laps in the pool. What other examples are related to water? Having your morning tea or your morning coffee. This mode, this mind wandering mode, allows us to do three things at one time. It allows us to rest. And so we expend mental energy whenever we have to regulate our attention in one way or another. This is why distractions are so exhausting. So, some days we spend the entire day because we don't have a lot of work to do. We just kind of bounce around between distractions and we find that we're exhausted. And it's because we expend mental energy whenever we have to realign our attention to focus on something. And so we rest up when we're taking a shower, or swim laps, or go for a walk. But at the same time, and this is a total, kind of ball from left field, because a curveball, I think, is the word that people use. Because I found that I had little energy when I was focusing all the time. And I thought, okay, what the hell am I doing wrong? I'm choosing what to focus on. I'm taming these distractions because they're so costly. I'm bringing my mind back. But it's because I never rested that I became burnt out. And I found that I worked in a more reactive way. And the fascinating thing that doing this led me to was where our mind wanders to when we let it rest and just be and not focus on anything. We think about the past a little bit when our mind is wandering, but we only think about the past around 12% of the time. The rest of the time, we're either thinking about the present and how to approach it more strategically, or we're thinking about the future. We think about when our mind is wandering, we think about the present 28% of the time, and we think about the future 48% of the time. And most of this time is spent on the immediate future. We're thinking about what we're going to work on next. We think about what we're going to do later on in the day. And most of us only get this in the shower, but it's worth getting this more often. And we think about our goals Here's one stat that that kind of changed the way I felt about this mind-wandering mode. Because I thought, okay, it's good for resting, but I like focusing on things, especially when they're novel and pleasurable and stuff. But we think about our goals 14 times as much when our mind is wandering versus when it's paying attention to something. And so in this way, it's by paying attention to things that we actually move our work and our life forward, but it's by stepping back and allowing some space between the cars that we set intentions, that we let our mind rest. And when we come up with ideas, because when we connect the past to the present to the future, that is when we come up with our most brilliant eureka insights, because we remember some nugget of information that we heard on a podcast a few weeks ago, and we connect that to a problem that we're facing at work, and then we form that connection, and bam, we come up with an idea that we wouldn't have arrived at otherwise focusing on something. And so I think it's because we bounce between these three mental destinations, our past, our present, and our future, and we also think about the information we've accumulated and connected, that this mode is so powerful and it's worth getting more of already.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to a conversation that has been packed with a ton of insight, which is what I've come to expect from you at this point after two of these conversations. So I want to
finish conversation
with my final question. And that is, What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I'm going to steal this answer from Seth Godin, and I'm sure he gave this answer when he was on the show. I haven't listened to that one yet, but it's that something is remarkable, not in the way that it's great, but in the fact that people will want to remark on it and about it. And I think the best ideas have that quality. Any book or show or anything that goes viral has that quality. I think what makes something unmistakable is that it's worth talking about and sharing. And that's my answer.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and the new book?
Yeah, the book is called Hyperfocus. It's available in bookstores everywhere, wherever books are sold. Yeah, my site is alifeofproductivity.com. And yeah, just thanks for listening. I hope there's some actionable nuggets.
And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamline my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.